The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine is a concert violinist, a recording artist, educator, philanthropist. Her repertory as a performer ranges from medieval and Renaissance music, Baroque music, all the way to new contemporary works. Harpsichordist Jory Vinicor enjoys an active career as a harpsichordist with some of the world's most prominent early music groups. Both musicians are Chicago natives with international careers as soloists, chamber musicians, and ensemble collaborators, and they recently teamed up to record Johann Sebastian Bach's sonatas for violin and harpsichord. Thank you to both of you for agreeing to chat today. So, you know, Bach is such a touchstone for so many musicians, and not even just classical musicians. So before we get into the specifics about your new recording of Bach's violin and harpsichord sonatas, I'd like each of you to sort of weigh in with your personal feelings about Bach in general.
Well, my feelings about Bach are very personal because I grew up in a church that I still attend, which actually has a stained glass window of Bach in the sanctuary. It's like, you know, people from the Bible, Bach, more people from the Bible. I was embarrassingly old when I figured out that Bach wasn't in the Bible. But it was wonderful, you know, just growing up, you know, from the age of two onwards when my parents joined the congregation. It's like the organist would play toccatas and fugues and the choir would play movements from cantatas and or sing movements from cantatas. And, you know, the music of Bach was very associated with worship for me, actually. And somehow that spiritual sense that I have with his music, I carry with me, you know, no matter what the setting is, whether it's playing for kids in a school or playing in a concert hall or anywhere else.
What about you, Jory?
I think as a young pianist, the music which spoke to me the most clearly and the soonest was definitely Bach. And my love for Bach's keyboard music surely brought me towards the harpsichord by my late teens. And even today, I don't think there's any experience comparable to performing the works of Bach, whether they're for solo keyboard or the works for violin and harpsichord, like I performed with Rachel, or even participating in the larger scale works.
Mm-hmm. So I want to just veer off a little bit on a tangent because you mentioned, you know, starting on piano, of course. I didn't expect that you started on harpsichord. So how did you make that transition? What happened? Did someone play the instrument for you? Did you sort of stumble on it in some other way? How did you become a harpsichordist?
I mean, of course, this is still rather true today in the United States. Music schools are not, so regular that you can just see every type of instrument, unlike France, where I was teaching kids as young as six when I taught in the national school system there. However, the public library afforded a great, great selection of recordings, and I became very curious quite soon on about performances of Bach and then other Baroque composers on the harpsichord, fell in love with the sound, never had the opportunity to even see an instrument before I went off to college. However, my very first day at college, Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, I sought out the harpsichord teacher and took lessons immediately. And then within, a couple of years, my interests really became more focused on the harpsichord.
Wow. That's pretty extraordinary.
I think the story isn't that different for many American players, particularly who come to the harpsichord.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how strings are different. I was definitely not the norm that I discovered Baroque violin and other early strings when I was 14 years old. Since I was lucky enough to be homeschooling to accommodate my music studies, I had the flexibility of schedule to explore some of my sort of side interests. And there were a number of wonderful specialists here in Chicago that I was able to take lessons with. And these days, the brilliant thing is that you can get a reasonably priced Baroque bow. For very little money and use it on your modern violin, which takes you more than halfway there. So even if you don't go the whole route of having a separate instrument and gut strings and the whole nine yards, you can actually play early music, you know, with a more historically informed approach, younger than you used to. My daughter started using a Baroque bow, a little fractional sized, at age 4, and she's 6 now, and she's got all the good habits. She'll never have to unlearn, wrong habits, which is just brilliant.
I'm so glad that you have mentioned just the specifics of your instruments and things like bows, because it's such an important part of every musician's life. And I think I'd like each of you to talk about your instruments. You know, like, Rachel, what about your violin and your bow, the one that you used for this recording? And what about the harpsichord you used for this recording as well, Jory? And you can go, either one of you can go first.
Yeah, well, I'm very honored that this particular album is actually Jory's own personal harpsichords recording debut, an instrument that he had in France and ultimately shipped over to Chicago, which was quite the adventure.
Yes.
And it's just absolutely gorgeous and as visually stunning as it is aurally magnificent. You can see it on the cover. That's not a prop. That's the real deal.
It is the real deal. So then I'll speak about that briefly. But here in Chicago, and even throughout much of the States, our access to many different harpsichords is not wonderful. If I were in Europe, I might have chosen an excellent copy of a German harpsichord, say a copy of an instrument by Zilbermann. Here in Chicago, I simply wanted the most beautiful instrument possible. I think very immodestly, yet accurately, that my harpsichord is the most beautiful instrument in the Midwest at this time. And it's an instrument built after a French copy by Tascan. So the original would be just 15 years after Bach's death, 1765, but a type of instrument that would have been familiar in France even 40 or so years before that. The instrument was made for me by a British builder, Tony Chinnery. He lives near Florence in Vicchio. I've had it in France since 2012, and about 2 years ago, I thought it was truly necessary to bring the instrument to Chicago, as it was just collecting dust in my French apartment, and this project with Rachel happened, and I think both of us were delighted with the mixture of the sounds. It's a rather lush-sounding harpsichord, and that goes extraordinarily well with Rachel's unbelievable tone. And generous phrasing.
Well, it's, yeah, very inspiring to play with an instrument like that. The recording, and I have no idea who the artists were. It was a cassette tape in my mom's station wagon at age 7 when I first heard these works. And the harpsichord sounded very plinky plinky. And I don't even know what the interpretation was, but that was sort of how I thought these works must be. And no, they're not at all like that.
No, and my harpsichord isn't. And no good harpsichord is really plinky, plinky. I think that's such a, even today in 2018, it's still a misconception we encounter. And people who will come to a recital of mine, usually under some kind of duress, are very, very surprised that the instrument does not sound in any way as they thought it might.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Well, and Baroque violins, you know, are so gorgeous if they're good ones.
Yes.
And often someone can form a misimpression of the sound of a Baroque violin through hearing maybe an instrument that's not, you know, not a good example or not well cared for, et cetera. I'm very, very lucky that I have an instrument by a renowned maker, Nicola Galliano, made in 1770, the very end of violins being made in the old way before they started to get re-necked and made with the new necks. And it's in really pristine condition. You know, a lot of old instruments maybe have been modernized long ago and you have to Baroque them back, or the good ones that are intact are living in museums. The fact that I was able to acquire this one from a shop in London back in 2001 was really a dream come true. And it's just, you know, an extraordinary voice. It's really funny that my Baroque violin is actually younger than my so-called modern violin, you know, the famous ex-soldat Guarneri del Gesu of 1742, same maker and same year as Paganini's instrument. That, of course, has been modernized. That's what I do my Brahms and Tchaikovsky concertos on. But then my Baroque violin is my other love. And, you know, playing it with the gut strings and everything, it just makes everything that I want to achieve with this repertoire so much easier and inspires me in very different ways.
So let's talk about this new CD. Now, sonata can have the connotation of, you know, a solo showpiece with accompaniment, you know. But these harpsichord and violin sonatas by Bach, they really are true collaborations between equal partners. Well, and I'm curious, you know, how'd you approach them? And especially because you have this personal friendship as well. And I'm wondering how that might have informed or affected your playing together.
Well, first I want to just say about sonatas. In the Baroque era, sometimes you would have, or usually you would have sonatas with a treble melody line and a basso continuo. Very different roles, but the continuo is by no means accompanimental. It's really the underpinning.
Generally.
Yeah, except maybe for some bad pieces.
Even Corelli, I mean, it's really solistic and then a fundamental bass.
Yeah. And then, of course, later on, you know, with the big violin and piano sonatas, it's very much chamber music.
Yes. But by the time you get to Mozart, even for Mozart, they're kind of piano sonatas with violin.
In many cases. So things kind of morphed. I mean, it was very interesting. You know, the keyboard rose to prominence. You no longer had the bowed bass or whatever plucky things going on. And then it was piano with a violin, and then the violin had to kind of, like, you know, work its way back up in the ensemble. But these are very unusual for the time because it's not a continuo part. There are moments or, you know, a couple of movements, you know, with rolling bass lines, but more often it's, you know, maybe three voices, left hand, right hand, and violin, that all have intertwining polyphonic parts or, you know, just a variety of different textures, all of which are very equal chamber music.
And this does seem to be a genuine innovation on Bach's part. I think we assume correctly that Bach is at such a summit of music at this time that we might forget that a number of innovations or inventions come from him. So the keyboard concerto is one. So the harpsichord concerto, which of course later morphs into piano concerti, that is a Bach thing. And then, as Rachel pointed out, these very egalitarian sonatas where violin or flute or viola da gamba, because there are sonatas for all of these with a written out harpsichord part, an obbligato harpsichord part, incredibly, incredibly new and unusual at this time.
So how about approaching these in particular for you two in your collaboration? Where do you start?
Well, after Jory, you know, did his education here in the U.S., he went off to Europe, and he lived in Europe for
24 years.
Okay, 24 years. And he would come back from time to time to visit friends and family, and we would often get together and just read music. And I loved Jory's Bach playing both on album and in person, his Goldberg variations. And, you know, I always thought in the back of my mind, if I ever record this particular cycle, I want to do it with Jory.
Thank you.
After he moved back, I mean, he's still obviously all over the world all the time, but Chicago is now his home base, no longer Paris. And that being the case, it gave us the opportunity to actually make this project a reality. But we've kind of been working towards it for decades at this point.
Isn't it a funny thing? Yeah. I think Rachel really had the idea for a recording project. I would have never dared it. And when we first read together, I think I was so, I hate to say it, but intimidated in a way, although Rachel is the most wonderful person as well. And then as we kept on getting together, and I think we both found a real facility in our own dialogue. Would you agree to that?
Absolutely.
Which is a necessity, not discussing every single point of articulation. Many things have gone unsaid in words, but very certainly said musically.
Well, I love that there's a spontaneity and flexibility that each time we play them, you know, we just kind of groove and jam and stuff like that. Obviously, we have to make some basic decisions, but a lot of it is just, you know, the flow of the music and our own musical interplay.
And how we create our own dialogue through this.
It's so interesting. Just listening to you talk, you have such a wonderful rapport. There's no question that you're good friends. And there's just a warmth and affection that comes out. And the way that you are sort of passing your comments back and forth is the way you play together, too. It's really lovely. I'm wondering, I'm going to stir the pot a little bit here. I'm wondering if there are any disadvantages to working on a project with someone you're so close to personally.
True confession. There's a girlfriend of mine, Wendy Warner, we made an album that I adore called Double Play, where we did the Schulhoff and Martineau and Kodaii and Ravel duos. And
I would like
Wendy,
a copy. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't
well,
have
I've
it.
Been remiss.
No.
Our friendship goes back to the early double digits. So age 10 and 12, I think, was the first time we were in string quartet together. And she served as one of my bridesmaids, etc. And the trouble is, every time we collaborate, we have to exercise extreme self-control to not let the entire rehearsal dissolve into a session of giggling. So luckily, I didn't have that problem with Jory.
I think we have a good time and we've gone out and had fun. But our rehearsals feel basically musical and very warm,
exactly.
Which is a fabulous combination.
Absolutely. And so, my daughter loves him.
And reciprocally. She is just she's precious. She's adorable.
That's sweet. It is, as I say, it's the warmth and rapport between you two is really evident. And I love hearing that.
I just have to embarrass Rachel for 1 second before you go on. But at a recent opera engagement where Sylvia, Rachel's daughter, came up to say hello, I think I responded to her, well, your mommy is wherever Rachel was at that moment. Mommy is in the lobby. We said, mommy is Rachel.
Oh, that's great. That is great. So... do each of you have a favorite among these sonatas? I know it's a little bit like asking a favorite child, but is there a particular one of these sonatas, and it may not even be the same one for both of you, that you just feel like, this is the one I love the best?
I have a favorite note.
What is a favorite note? Try me.
The last low harpsichord note of the first movement of the first sonata in B minor.
Okay.
It's da-da-da-da-da-da, and then... boom. There's something like that just gets me in the gut. Like, I don't know why that, like, that note, I just live for it. But I don't know. It's like whichever one you're playing is just absolutely glorious.
And basically speaking, they're all very different. That's not 100% true. I mean, for instance, B minor and A major maybe have more resemblance, let's say, than others, but all are so wonderful. Rachel and I both have commented that the E major was kind of our first.
Yeah, that was the one I did for the Bach Leipzig competition and, you know, have performed the most over the years.
And coincidentally, as have I.
It's kind of the most popular, but for a reason. But, you know, the F minor is very strange and chromatic and very intimate, and it's kind of an acquired taste almost, but so rewarding. And then, of course, the G major is very extroverted and brilliant.
And more concerto-like, as it were.
Yes, yes. And the C minor, you know, has this gorgeous Sicilian first movement and the wonderful second movement fugue. And then the A major is just so...
I've loved playing the A major.
Lovely and happy.
I think on our upcoming recitals... I believe we play the B minor and E major together.
Yeah.
Is that correct? And B minor is just glorious, also showing some unusual textures. Rachel and I both spoke about these sonatas as trio sonatas, so harpsichord, left hand, right hand, violin. Mm-hmm. But Bach, of course, changes textures in the first movement of the B minor. The right hand of the harpsichord is two-voiced, et cetera. So that's just beautiful. And the E major, the first movement is so tremendously unusual.
Yeah, and just very, very rich with ornaments and written out ornaments in the violin part.
Well, an extraordinary high and florid violin solo line with a chorale-like and very densely written harpsichord part.
And a very fun last movement.
Oh, yes, that's hysterical. Wow.
But you know, the movement that is so close to our hearts is the excised cantabile. Mm-hmm. Bach, for his sixth sonata, the one in G major, he went through all these different iterations of versions of movements, of orders of movements, of inclusion of movements. He ultimately ended up with all the other sonatas are four movements, slow, fast, slow, fast. The usual scheme, the sixth sonata is fast, slow, harpsichord alone movement, another slow movement.
And then, also permutated from various iterations.
And then ending with a fast movement. So it's kind of an arc. And there's this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous kind of aria-like slow movement, which is 7.5 minutes long or something like that. And I can't help but think that he excised it not because he thought that it, the quality didn't match up. Absolutely not. It probably just didn't sort of fit proportionately with the final scheme. But so it's this kind of, extra movement sort of hanging out there. And we often play it for an encore or a standalone, and it's, I don't know. It's just so
the time stands
remarkable.
Still for it.
Yes.
That and maybe I'm going to actually say that's my favorite movement. If I have to, kind of a heart leaving something or other, it's very dear.
Well, exactly. If I had to pick just one movement alone, it would have to be that one.
I will go for that as well, yes.
Well, given this simpatico that you share, I hope you've already got some future collaborations planned.
Concerts, several concerts.
Which I look forward to with the greatest enthusiasm. And at some point or another, when we have time to come down to earth, we'll talk about what future collaboration might be possible, what we would want to do together.
Yeah,
I have
what
some
do you think
little
that might
ideas.
Be? Oh, okay. You're going to keep that under your hat at this point?
Possibly.
Okay.
I'll tell Rachel.
Okay. So there's an expression that I really like, and I think it applies to so many of my musical friends, my musician friends, and that is that the more you love music, the more music you love. And I happen to know, Rachel, everybody knows that you have exceptionally far-reaching musical tastes. I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about your thing for heavy metal music?
Oh, well, you'd think it's the polar opposite of early music, but actually when Jory and I did a house concert at my condo right before the recording sessions to just finish our preparation work, a number of my friends from the heavy metal community were in the audience.
That's
because
true.
They all love Bach.
Yeah.
So you had this funny mix of arts patrons and friends and colleagues and then all these guys with long hair and tattoos.
And they were rapt in attention.
Oh, yeah. They were eating it up. Metal and classical have historically always been very close in terms of metal's influence from classical music, or at least the more sophisticated subgenres. And recently I've had the opportunity to commission a handful of composers who are themselves metal fans to write classical pieces with metal as an inspiration, kind of like, the whole tradition of Bernstein being influenced by jazz or Bartok being influenced by Hungarian folk music. So I have a couple of solo pieces and a couple of concertos that have been written for me that actually use the kinds of rhythms and, I don't know what you would call it, melodic riffs, not any kind of cheesy crossover rock and roll concerto. I mean, we're talking about the acoustic violin, a normal orchestra, a classical piece of music where heavy metal as another kind of music happens to be one of the building blocks of that particular piece of art music. So I think that's a very wonderful development in the world. And it's been nice to see that these concert works are enjoyed by people who aren't necessarily metal fans or are unfamiliar with metal, but they just listen to it for its own self and appreciate it.
Yeah, cool. So building some bridges there. Jory, what other kinds of music do you enjoy? Are you also a heavy metal kind of guy?
I am not. I am most highly amused by Rachel's relation to this. And I'm sure I told Rachel this a handful of years ago. I was stuck in a miserable airplane situation, like 10 hours late coming back from Paris. And on my plane was a heavy metal band called Lamb of God. Do you know who they
are? Those guys are amazing. Yeah, I just saw them in New York.
And so I struck up a conversation with a couple of them. Very, very nice people, taken away from their look and the performance thing. They're very articulate. When I said what I did, there was not a kind of a, you know, a dumb look. They knew very well what a harpsichord was. Yeah. And so with these guys, we had a great conversation for a few of these rotten hours of being
stuck.
Did you
ever go on YouTube and check out their music?
Very little bit. And they're accomplished. They're very accomplished, but it's just not my thing. I think if I have my, I won't call it a guilty pleasure, but something really out of classical would probably be the older 60s, 70s folk music, Joan Baez, Judy Collins.
Oh, nice. Sort
My
daughter
thing.
Likes that stuff, actually.
I love it.
She so listens to Peter, Paul, and Mary lately.
And I find them immensely touching. Yeah.
So you know one of my favorite early music albums, I can't remember the name of the group. It's like a medieval Renaissance ensemble from Russia. And they released an album called Sabbatum. And it's taking Black Sabbath songs, singing them in Latin in a medieval style.
Oh, wow.
And they totally work because that particular music is very pentatonic already. Mm. And, like, it's my favorite interpretation of War Pigs.
I think I remain to be convinced, but I'm glad to hear it.
Well, it just sounds like medieval music. If you didn't know it came from Black Sabbath, you would just think it was something ancient.
Wow.
Wow, indeed, yeah. I've been speaking with violinist Rachel Barton Pine and harpsichordist Jory Vinicor. Their 2018 recording of Johann Sebastian Bach's harpsichord and violin sonatas is on the CD recording label. Thanks to both of you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's been lovely to meet you.